we're going to kick off our fifth lesson this evening with the outline I closed with last week. Very brief, but if you'd like to have a general overview or reference point to write perhaps at the head of the book of Leviticus in your Bibles, it is pretty clearly and easily outlined in that the first seven chapters, and we read from quite a bit of them last week, the first seven chapters have to do with laws of sacrifice. In fact, the first several chapters, each one is devoted to a particular kind of sacrifice. We'll be coming back to those in future lessons, but that's what Leviticus, our chief concern in this class, is doing in the first seven chapters. And then you have an historical narrative, kind of an interlude in the rest of the book. But chapters 8, 9, and 10 then tell the story of the inauguration of those first priests, and of course ends with the terrible story of Nadab and Abihu and their awful failure, which teaches us so much about the character of God and how very jealously He guards the proper worship that He gives to us, to them at that time, and to us as well today. He cares how He is worshipped, not according to our will and our desires and what pleases us, but according to His and to His alone. Now we have chapters 11 through 15, which distinguish between those things that are clean to the Jews and that are unclean. Pardon me, got something stuck in my throat there. But in chapter 16, you have a single chapter. The one time you're going to have only one chapter that stands out by itself. But the Day of Atonement is the most significant of all of the Jewish feast days. It is the highest day. It comes but once a year. The high priest alone permitted into the Holy of Holies. And so chapter 16's Day of Atonement stands pretty well right there in the middle of the book as well. And then you have the remainder of the book, chapter 17 through 26, where this key phrase is used over and over again, "You shall be holy, for I am holy." It is a great call then to purity, to righteousness, to virtue, and that for the Old Testament peoples as well as for us. We're going to find, particularly when we get into these chapters, there'll be a number of things that will seemingly be just incomprehensible to us today. Some of these things would not be incumbent upon us today, but we can still yet learn a great deal from the very specific laws that were laid upon the shoulders of these people called Jews and Hebrews and Israelites. I would like to add then two things to our introductory material, and really in a sense I guess I'm still in introductory material for the whole class tonight, but two things that I didn't mention last week about the nature of Leviticus in particular I thought I'd just point out here. There is no other book in the Torah that points to Moses like Leviticus does. Who can tell me what the word Torah means? What is the Torah? T-O-R-A-H. Yes, it's the first five books of our Old Testament, but specifically, it is the five books then written by Moses. The Torah is, in the Jewish eyes, throughout history, and very prominently so, for them, tremendously more important, or at least highly respected, perhaps you might say, than anything else in the Old Testament. And for them, they have Torah scrolls, of course, which are these five books that then have extremely elaborate, exquisite work that is done to protect them, carvings, engravings, and whatnot, silver, and all kinds of different things that you might see. But they revere those five books, and each synagogue's copy thereof, and parade them about in various circumstances. That is really interesting, at least to see, but certainly demonstrates their towering respect for Moses and the law that God gave them. So Torah refers to the five books, but will be a word that's used extremely often, just constantly by the Jews, falsely so-called, if you will, to this day, at least not by biblical definition, but to this day, those who are claiming some sort of relationship. And then some form of "the Lord said to Moses," that actual phrase, occurs 33 times in this book. So in the midst of these five, the Torah, Leviticus emphasizes far more than any other that God is imparting law to Moses, that God is conversing with Moses, that Moses in a face-to-face exchange is receiving information from the Lord. So no other book points to Moses like this book does. Now, I think of all the books of the Old Testament, maybe the Old Testament, but at least in the Torah, Leviticus is the most neglected. And it's really too bad. If you'll spend some time with it, and I grant that it can be very confusing, I grant that it can feel kind of repetitious, I grant that it feels dry, I grant, all of these things, but it's a gold mine. And as you get into Leviticus, there are just innumerable lessons to be learned. So despite the fact it is particularly geared to the Levites as the priests of God, particularly geared to the elaborate sacrificial system of the Old Testament, and particularly not being practiced today by anybody on the planet, it's impossible, the Jews themselves know that, as they call themselves today, but it's just full of information that really is enlightening and encouraging and helpful, challenging, motivating. A great, great book, not to be neglected at all. So point number one I'd like to add to last week's lesson is that here is Moses in this very intimate setting, chapter after chapter after chapter, hearing directly from God what he will then decree and record, establish and practice for the last 40 years of his life as they're going through the wilderness wanderings there in the tabernacle, of course, looking forward to centuries that lie ahead for the Jews. Number two, this is a picture of Luke Chandler, who was the guide on the last trip that we took here back in May and June. This is, as you can see, Beersheba, though it's pronounced a number of different ways, and Hebrews ordinarily would put a V where that last B is. But however you would pronounce that, from Dan to Beersheba is that expression you hear so often in Scripture to refer to the promised land. Here in the very far south of Israel, then, was discovered, this is an exact replica, the original is in the Israel Museum, but this is an exact replica, right down to the pit marks and all on the stones, of a Canaanite altar discovered at Beersheba, and then predating whom, if it's a Canaanite altar, then it precedes the Jews coming into their promised land. My point being that what you have here then is a demonstration of the fact that animal sacrifice and other sacrifices, various kinds of vegetation and drink offerings, but sacrifice in general is not at all unique to the Israelites. It predates them by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So we need to just remember that. It's kind of easy. Our focus is always on the Jews. I think they get to thinking it, like they're different from everybody else. They're really not that much at all. And in fact, this is a Canaanite altar preceding the Jews. But on the corners, it has what? It has the four horns of an altar. The Jews were not at all unique in having horns on their altars. So what is Luke demonstrating for our group as we were standing there in Beersheba and he was giving us our introduction to the archaeological site? What is he demonstrating? Something you read about in Moses' law. What is he doing? Okay, if something goes real wrong, whether intentionally or accidentally, up to and often including somebody has died and it was an accident, you didn't mean to do it, but if you're involved in an accidental loss of life, then what? You run. Because what does the family have the right to do if they can catch you before you get here? kill you, put you to death. Blood must be avenged. Even if it's an accident, the family has that right. So you race off, then you grab a hold of the horns of the altar. This then is an appeal for sanctuary, I guess we would say, and for justice. The priest then would protect you, and a trial date would be arranged. Witnesses would be called, and there will be, you know, justice served in a proper manner, carefully, you know, quietly, with calm spirits, logically, not emotionally, considering the evidence. So he's demonstrating how that would be done. What you'll notice there is that this particular altar, and many altars that have been found or that are dimensions are given, are really not all that big, are they? Really not all that big. And they surprised me, particularly this one, because it would seem to me rather difficult to build a fire on this, something this small. As you see, what is that, about 4 or 5 feet square is all, you know, in a flat surface on the top there. It'd be kind of difficult to get a fire going big enough to really burn an animal. It would be difficult. You'd be stoking that fire and working with it, you know, a lot of tenants going on and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, this is, you know, what their sacrifices look like as well. So, tonight, that's my lead-in to a discussion of sacrifice in general. Not the specific sacrifices of Leviticus yet. We're going to spend some more time with them. But I just want to look at the nature of sacrifice itself. So we'll start here in Genesis chapter 3 and at verse 21, which is immediately following on the heels of God's statement of consequences for the sin that Adam and Eve have committed. So they tried to hide themselves. He, of course, recognizes what they've done. And the Lord then, beginning, you know, with 11, who told you you were naked? Man said, the woman. Lord said to the woman, what is it you've done? And then begins at verse 14, to the serpent, to the man and the woman, the consequences of their sin. Consequences that we experience to this day. Is childbirth still difficult? Why, of course. Do we still make a living by the sweat of our brow? Yeah, you know, that's kind of an odd thing, because often enough, you know, you're working for the internet or something. Donna spends all day at Bi-Mart sitting in a chair, you know, and so not a lot of sweat, actually. But it's an expression. What does it mean? You're going to have to work to make a living. And so the ground's going to be tougher, you know, and as all these other things come up, people spend typically a minimum of 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and often a great deal more, you know, trying to make a living. You have to eke out a living, we say. So we have many consequences, you know, that are still in force today because of the existence of sin. But immediately after those consequences, in verse 20, Eve is named, and then in 21, the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. Freely recognizing, this does not say that a sacrifice was offered. But it does demonstrate that the consequence of their sin, they ate the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they now have that knowledge, they immediately hide themselves because they recognize shame has entered into our lives. A cognizance of nakedness. Shame has come. We must hide ourselves. And then animals die that they might be clothed, that they might be covered. So whether you want to put this one as first in our list or not, at least here is a consequence of sin that now falls upon animals. Were just Adam and Eve cursed? The ground was cursed. The entire ecological system of the earth was cursed. It all was cursed because of them. And animals died that they might be clothed. However, we have no doubt in the next chapter, at verses 3 and 4, just a couple of verses later, verse 3 and 4, Genesis 4, it came about in the course of time, Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground, and Abel, in verse 4, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of their fat portions. The Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and for his offering he had no regard. So Cain became very angry, his countenance fell, and the murder, of course, is on the way. Well, an offering to God is understood. Immediately, we learn in Genesis, it is being practiced. No information about it has been given, but we are told that it exists. A concept of humankind bringing something that is of value to them, would have cost them effort and work, some of that sweat to acquire, needs to be surrendered, offered to God. An attempt must be made to atone, to pay, to balance somehow the books. We're in a deficit, and we need to try to make it up. Now, the next we read about sacrifice is over here in Genesis and chapter 8. So again, only a few chapters each time. A little bit more information is given. So in Genesis chapter 8, we'll start the reading at verse 18 and then end the chapter. Noah went out of what? Well, the ark. His sons, his wife, and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by their families from the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord. Took of every clean animal. Remember, he'd been instructed to take seven, probably seven pairs, we're not sure, but a good deal more than just the two. Of every clean bird. He took of every clean animal, of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. What was the first chapter of Leviticus devoted to? Burnt offerings. Here is the first occurrence of a burnt offering. Moses, you know, will follow much later. Noah is just getting off the ark. What's the first thing he does? He offers a burnt offering. This then is a thing that is entirely consumed. This then is a thing that is utterly lost to them. This is a serious sacrifice. You know, considering the total population of the world's animals has gotten to be pretty small. You know, and we're still going to give some up here. You know, but we wonder, you know, why? Not a lot of insight into it, just the existence of it somehow. So, in verse 21, the Lord smelled the soothing aroma. And the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And please note, not from his birth. From his youth, and I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, which necessarily implies what? It's not going to always remain, but while it does, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So the earth is going to go on for a while. And it will always have its regular seasons. I am not going to destroy this planet like I've just done with a year of floodwaters. I'm not going to do that again. Now, why, or at least what is associated with God saying, I will never do that again. What's associated with God's motivation? What prompted God to make that declaration?
The sacrifice.
It's the sacrifice. There isn't anything else there. And so Noah built an altar. Immediately comes out of the ark, he builds him an altar. He sacrifices birds and everything that moves, creeping things too. Every clean animal and every clean bird. I was reading the wrong verse. Those two. And then, 21, what happened? The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, I'll never again curse the ground on account of man. There's a direct relationship. They're associated. They're linked. So God responded to this sacrifice. He had the option and had left it open that if man ever gets like this again, I could do this again. How long did it take from Adam's sin to Noah's flood? You have to remember, and I don't know why this figure sticks in my head. I'm glad it does, but I don't know why. 1,676 years. You had it written down, didn't you? Did I get it right? Yeah. Okay. So Lee had it written down. So if they could do it that way the first time, could you do it again in that length of time? Could you cut that time in half? Could we not have had 27 floods by now and looking at another one coming? Yeah, except for what? Well, apparently except Noah went out and offered a sacrifice. And the Lord looked at it. It is described as smelling it, found that aroma soothing. Now again, brethren, I hope I'm not going too far here, because there is no explanation given. But does that not paint a picture of God's wrath having endured for a year? Everything's been destroyed on the surface of the earth. And now there is for God a soothing, an abatement of this wrath. And then he declares, I will never do that again. So you get the idea of an atonement. Payment has been made. We are even. I appreciate that. I won't do that again. Okay? Now, I've been having some very interesting discussions with another preacher friend of mine, another staying on the phone, about the nature of God and expressions like, now I know, how could God not know? This is another one of these kind of conundrums, you know, that we wrestle with right here. God would have known. It is his plan, we suppose. You know, how could he change? I don't want to get into all those philosophical discussions, largely because I don't have answers for them. It is often difficult to appreciate, comprehend, understand, you know, what is a picture. Think of, you know, some sort of metaphor or simile or example. It's some way that God is giving us a figure to understand something, or how literally we ought to take that thing. But at any rate, laying, you know, those imponderables aside, which God hasn't addressed, so, you know, maybe we're never going to know. As we look at this, sacrifice is pretty deeply ingrained in these people already, isn't it? How many Jews are there on the earth? Well, how long's old Abraham been living when this event goes down? he's way off in the future. So at this point in time, there was just people. No Jew-Gentile relationship existed. And now we come off the ark and there's just these people. They're going to populate the earth again. Off we go in world history. But sacrifice is deeply ingrained in the human psyche. Now, if we dare at this point, what is seemingly the only reason why that would be the case? What do we suspect has happened in the background that hasn't been mentioned yet? God's told them so. God has told them so. Now, you know, I just can't imagine that, you know, some children grow up in some country that's never heard of the Bible or anything like that, you know, and then these children grow up, and one day one of the kids goes out and, you know, he accidentally burns the hut down, you know. And so he goes out, you know, quickly and brings his favorite pet and kills it for his dad to appease his dad's wrath. Would that occur to you? don't think it would occur to me. You know, it would seem to me you're just making matters worse. We've already lost the house, and now what are you doing? You know, I wouldn't think it would come to me. So I mean, we're imagining something's been going on behind the scenes, right? We will, of course, learn over the Hebrew letter, Cain and Abel's sacrifice. One is by faith, the other's not. Faith comes by hearing. So the suggestion is certainly there. They must have heard what they were supposed to offer, and they could only have heard it from God. And so God's been teaching about sacrifice, apparently, hasn't he? Looks like it. Now, last of these in Genesis, let's come on over to chapter 15. In Genesis 15, really interesting, and thanks to another preacher, Daryl Emel, in this case, in Colorado. He has a wondrous book. It's called A Topical Study of the Law of Moses. I highly recommend it, and I will be using it as one of my sources repeatedly throughout this class. But Daryl Emel is spelled H-Y-M-E-L, Daryl Emel. I think he's in Longmont, Colorado, if I'm not mistaken, but he's somewhere in Colorado there. And I think you'll be able to find him online. But you really need to own a copy of that book. I've used it as an actual workbook and had the whole class buy it, you know, many, many years ago. I decided not to do it this time with Leviticus and Deuteronomy, but he's done an absolutely marvelous, marvelous job there in giving you a fairly brief overview of the law. So, Topical Study of the Law of Moses by Daryl Emel, one I highly recommend. Okay, so this particular string of verses, for instance, I actually got from him. And we want to start reading now chapter 15, verses 7 through 21, where he points out something about this sacrifice that I doubt I would have ever, you know, had the presence of mind to recognize. So in 15:7, he said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to possess it." So whom must God be speaking to? Abraham. And he said to him, 8, "O Lord God, how may I know that I shall possess it?" So he said to him, "Bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon." Now, what I would not have noticed is that we'll see in Leviticus, these are the same animals that you find over there. So in verse 11, 10, he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses and Abram drove them away. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." It came about when the sun had set, it was very dark, behold, a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. The Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite." The names of the peoples currently living in that land. "I'm going to give you this land." Now that's an amazing moment in history, isn't it? It's weird. By the way, And I do recommend this. I think it'll do you good. But I warn you, you know, with an R rating, if you'll go to Google and then remove, you know, that search filter, whatever search filter stuff you've got, okay, so that you can get whatever the net offers. You go to Google and you just type in the two words, animal sacrifice, and then close one eye and squint the other. Okay? Because what you'll see is very like this. You'll see that animal sacrifice is being practiced today all over the world. You'll see high definition photos, and it's bloody. Man, it's awful. It just makes us recoil in horror. But that will give you a much clearer idea of what we're talking about. He went in there. He took four kinds of animals to sacrifice. He cut three of them in half. He separated their pieces big enough that you could walk between them, apparently. And then this miraculous vision and perhaps actual thing, you know, appears, passes between the two, apparently just floating between them. What I'm talking about is the smoking oven and the flaming torch in verse 17. Smoking oven, flaming torch, and passed between the pieces. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant. So Abram offered a very singular sacrifice here. It isn't repeated elsewhere, though the component parts will figure highly in Moses' law. And when he does this, God makes a covenant. And it is a tremendous covenant, isn't it? I'm going to give you the land that is currently occupied by all these other nations. You're going to go into captivity, and then you're going to come out, your people, many years from now. But when all that's over, you're going to have a promised land, Abram. Now, this is chapter 15. And God is making a covenant complete with the promise of a land. Has God done this before with Abram? Still hasn't changed his name, father of many nations, but has he done this before with Abram? He did it in chapter 13, and he did it in chapter 12. This is the first time you see Abraham, what he'll become, Abram now, you know, offering this sacrifice, and then you have this covenant. So, God isn't telling us what was said, but Abram, I think, is being led by God and is responding to God with as much faith as apparently, thanks to the Hebrew letter, we learn that Abel was. That God wanted these people to understand when there is sin or a covenant, then what do you need? You need blood. You need to become a butcher. You need to learn how to kill. And then to cut and to separate, you know, to work with it. Now, I don't know how many hours those pieces lay out there. Birds of prey coming down despite, you know, an individual being there. They got pretty aggressive. And, you know, and then sunsets before the vision comes. But look at that. We have cleared 15 chapters. Is sacrifice unique to the Jews? Well, just not at all. Now, let's go to this picture. Now, I've done this before several times, but if you don't know the website, www.bible.ca, that's Steve Rudd. Steve Rudd, R-U-D-D. He is an archaeologist, does some digging in Israel there, was working at Shiloh when we were there last year, though we didn't get to see him. But www, it's a Canadian website, of course. He lives in Hamilton. So Bible.ca, he has one of the most full websites I've ever seen, with, I don't know, maybe hundreds of charts like this. And you can see he's working with a mannequin that he's superimposed. And then this is actually a life-sized tabernacle replica that's been built. I believe it's in a city called Timnah, way down in the southern deserts, well below Beersheba even. But they try to make a life-size one right there. You can see he superimposed the fire on it. He took the original picture. But at any rate, it gives us the size of the altar. And what I'd like for you to do, I'm just going to leave that picture up there, this altar of burnt offerings. But remember last week's class, this
had already been built in the latter chapters of Exodus. When you turn the page and read right on the continuing narrative, that is the book of Leviticus. So now we're going to have the priests, now we're going to have the sacrifices, because now they've built all of this material. What I'd like to do is to step back to Exodus 27 now, have you come with me in these eight verses. And in Exodus chapter 27, 13 chapters before Leviticus gets started, so all this has already been done. But in Exodus 27, let's read about this altar. In 27:1, you shall make the altar of acacia wood. It's a wooden altar. 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. The altar shall be square and its height shall be 3 cubits. Now, I don't know if I've told you this before, but what does everybody immediately respond? How long's a cubit? How many inches? 18. That may not be correct at all. You'll also hear it was whatever the length, you know, from elbow to fingertips of whoever the king was at that time. These things may all be true at various times in history and for a variety of peoples. But I would at least like to lay on the table here, brother, that it is perhaps more likely that the cubit of the day, and that might have been favored by the Jews, particularly if you're building a tabernacle or an altar, because it is referred to as the royal cubit, is not 18 inches. It's 20.6. Okay? So it's 20 and a half inches. That can make a very significant difference in the dimensions. So as a rule of thumb, you keep doing it, it's just fine. It's about a foot and a half. But it could be more than that. It could be 2.5 inches more than that. And therefore, you know, it's hard to tell. What he suggests right here is that he wants to use the old Egyptian royal cubit, 20.6 inches. And I would very much trust Steve on that. It would be more likely. So that gives us 8.6 by 8.6, so call it 8.5 feet, by 5.15 feet. So 8.5 by 8.5 by essentially 5. Now, is that considerably bigger than the Canaanite altar we just saw? Yes. And you're about to learn this is not stone to begin with, which raises all kinds of questions on how you don't burn it down, you know, every time you light it up. I think probably what they're saying is, you know, it's a non-combustible interior, and then it's going to be decorated with the acacia wood. But nonetheless, you know, it'd be about that size. They were trying to use the replica size, you know, full size there. So then, in verse 2, you shall make its horns on its four corners. Its horns shall be of one piece with it, and you shall overlay it with bronze. You shall make its pails for removing its ashes, and its shovels, its basins, its forks, and its fire pans. You shall make all its utensils of bronze. So apparently, on the inside is my guess. If you make it out of acacia, you put the acacia on the inside, then what? That doesn't last. So apparently the bronze would have been on the inside, the acacia on the outside. What did these people, when they did it, what did they do? They apparently put the bronze on the outside. Well, I don't know. And how about those horns? Does anybody know what the horn looked like? You have no idea. Totally different than what the Canaanites did in his picture, but we don't know. This, as I've said before, I think is important. Could any Jew today actually go and recreate exactly what Moses had if they wanted to try and jumpstart, you know, put the defibrillator on their old religion? No. Couldn't do it. It required, I think, at first, inspired direction, which is talked about in the text, by God and or by prophets in years to come. And by the tradition of the Levites being passed down so they knew exactly how to do it. That is long ago all of that been lost. And everybody who claims to be a Jew today knows it. They know it. It can't be recreated. I think that was done for a purpose because God intended that it not be revived. Then in verse 4, you shall make for it a grating of network of bronze, and on the net you shall make four bronze rings at its corners. You shall put it beneath, under the ledge of the altar, that the net may reach halfway up the altar. You shall make poles for the altar, poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with bronze, and its poles shall be inserted into the rings, so that the poles shall be on the two sides of the altar when it is carried. You shall make it hollow with planks, as it was shown to you in the mountain, so they shall make it. Now again, I want to emphasize, brother, maybe both sides were covered in bronze, the acacia woods in the inside and all that. You know, we really don't know. But, like what they did here, somehow there was one piece that was made that isn't made out of acacia wood. It's a grate, a metal grate, that's going to have rings extending through to the outside, halfway down, so that you could put the rod through there, acacia wood covered with bronze, and you'd be able to pick this thing up and move it. It'd be really heavy, too. That's pretty big, covered with bronze, acacia wood. Really heavy. And so, those rings, I'm thinking, would have been a whole lot bigger. The acacia wood going through there would have been much bigger. Because in this particular one, you wouldn't have picked that up. First, you don't have handle enough for people to even be able to lift it. And if you did, it'd probably snap right off, wouldn't it? Well, it did not look like that, but it looked something like that. But halfway inside there, there's a metal grate. Now, could you build a fire that you could really keep? And would the ashes have somewhere to go? And could you then pile on a lot of meat? See, this is a whole lot more efficient, effective, useful, you know, mass-producing sacrifices than the Canaanite thing. But still, it kind of, you know, it gives you an idea. Now, when everything was done, it looks something like this. There are several different layers, you know, of skins that cover it, three of them. You know, you've got the bronze laver filled with water for the washing. You've got these slaughtering tables, so you can do a lot of slaughtering at a single time. There's a ramp that goes up to this altar, okay, and then an enclosure all the way around. Now, did any of you know what a football field is? Now, put yourself in the stands at the Autzen Stadium. You look down at the football field. It'd be real close, this enclosure, to exactly as you stood, you know, at the 50-yard line in the high of the stadium, and you look down there, it'd be just about exactly what one quarter of your football field would look like. Half as long and half as wide. Real close to those same dimensions. Don't know if you use 18 inches or 20.6, you know, a lot of stuff going on, but effectively, it's about that enclosure is about one quarter the size of a typical football field. Now, perfect timing. With my last 15 minutes, what I'd like to do is to work through this passage. We're going to close with Hebrews. Please come to Hebrews chapter 9. With all these visuals, with all of this information, with all of this background now, let's go and have a look at Hebrews chapter 9. I'm going to read the whole chapter, and then we're going to roar on in. Got to cover them both up to chapter 10. We're going to do most of chapter 10 too. Now, I just love to do, you know, 10-minute commentary on each verse. Of course, we can't. But I'm hoping that if you have all of this vision in your mind now, we will read these two chapters. And hopefully things will just kind of bubble up to the surface now that maybe without a more precise overview like we've just done, kind of escape us. So let's go to chapter 9 of verse 1 in Hebrews. Even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary. There was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, in which were the lampstand and the table and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. And behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense. That'd be a much smaller thing, of course, just for incense. And the Ark of the Covenant, covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna, and Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. Above it were the cherubim of glory, overshadowing the mercy seat. But of these things we cannot now speak in detail. Thanks to that verse, I don't have to either. So we didn't deal with all of it. But verse 6. Now, when these things have been thus prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine worship. But into the second only, the high priest enters once a year, not without blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people, committed in what? What was the word we read last week in Leviticus? You commit a sin, it wasn't in ignorance, it was a sin unintentionally. Same thing. Now, verse 8, here comes one of several really big conclusions. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until a time of reformation. Now, there's a couple of terms in there that ought to be really intriguing to us, and we've studied them in other contexts, Revelation not the least. We're not going to get into that tonight. But the Holy Spirit in verse 8 was signifying that the way into the holy place is not yet disclosed while this tabernacle or its replacement, the temple, because this has been long gone, he says it's a symbol for the present time with the Hebrew letters written there in the middle of the 60s A.D. So he has to be referring to the temple there when he talks about these sacrifices being offered. Why is that thing standing? The Holy Spirit is signifying something. What is he telling you? When that tabernacle and then the temple were standing, he was saying the way into the holy place is not yet disclosed while those things exist. A symbol for the present time when the Hebrew letter was written. But then there were going to be changes, brethren, at the end of verse 10, when the time of the Reformation comes. What do you suppose the time of the Reformation is then? The time when the way into the holy place will be disclosed. The temple will be torn down, vanish. And now, where's the holy place? It's in heaven. Has the way been opened that we might enter? Yes. And who did it? Jesus. Because he became a sacrifice. Bill, got to be really quick. I just got minutes left.
Is he speaking of the time when the temple is destroyed or when Jesus rises?
He's talking about the time when the temple is destroyed. As long as that thing stands, the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed. I know that's extremely intriguing. It's something important, too, I think. We don't have time for it tonight. We often think everything's done, you know, when Jesus rises from the dead. This passage says no. But we have to study it another time. Okay, now, verse 11. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling those who've been defiled sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, you've already learned, brethren, that it could not cleanse what? Verse 9, it could not make you perfect in what? At verse 9, in conscience. It could have something to do with sanctifying and cleansing of the flesh, but not the conscience. 14. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? For this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, in order that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant is valid only when men are dead, which is a terrible translation and extremely misleading, and I don't have time to tell you about it. Study Hebrews hopefully later. But it should read, covenant is only valid when the one who makes it is dead. Okay? Not a last will and testament at all. Okay? Because Moses instituted a new covenant, and what man died to do that? No man died to do that. Animals died, and the animals were the ones' blood that made the covenant. More on that some other time. It's never enforced while the one who made it lives. That is, while the sacrificial animal's blood has not yet been spilled. It hasn't died. It still lives. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves. That's the blood of the one who made it. And the goats. There's blood. They made it. With water, scarlet wood, and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you. Not a last will and testament, but a sacrifice. An animal dies to establish a covenant. We have the only covenant established when a man died. Verse 21, in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. And according to the law, almost all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness. Why does it say almost all things are cleansed with blood? What is not cleansed with blood, but is cleansed? Anything made out of clay or wood, because what would the blood then do? It'd soak in. Okay? So those things are specifically told you don't sprinkle blood on them. You're likely to start diseases and plagues. So you don't be doing that. So it's almost everything, but not clay. Then, without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness. Is that true? Is it universally true? Yes. Yes, it is. And that's how we got the first covenant. They shed the blood of these animals. 23, therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Nor was it that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place year by year with blood not his own. Otherwise, he would have needed to suffer often, Jesus would have, since the foundation of the world. But now, once at, here's another phrase you'll find very interesting in your study of last things, at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. When Jesus died on the cross, what were they in? They were in the consummation of the ages. They were in the end of the age. At that time. What age was ending? Moses' age. 27. And inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sons of many, shall appear a second time for salvation without sin to those who eagerly await him. Now, obviously, I can't get through 22 more verses, so we'll stop there. We'll start with chapter 10. Please be reading those first 22 verses this week, and then next week we'll come back and we'll finish that. But brethren, what are you learning about? The necessity of animal sacrifice, but also the limited efficacy of animal sacrifice. Without it, there is no covenant. Without it, there is no forgiveness. But with it, Is there a perfection or cleansing of conscience? No, there's not. They're animals. When Jesus dies on the cross, can there be both forgiveness and a clean conscience? The ultimate payment has been made. The balance has come even. All forgiveness is now here. Okay? So read chapter 10, particularly tonight. I think it'll do you good. I wish I could have got it all in, but it's the nature of the material. Okay, class dismissed.